they need more than they'll ever, ever use on any level. I mean, we're creating wealth for someone's great, 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 yet to be born great, great, great grandchildren.
When I need some money.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
They don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now. Now.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Jessica Irvine, phlebotomist at the Pocono Medical Center, one of the people walking on the bitterly cold picket line yesterday to draw attention to the fact that, you know, since September, they have been trying to negotiate a contract with Pocono Medical Center. And again, the employer has chosen to go the hard way. To be the roadblock, to be the honestly and truthfully the Grinch in the room, if you will, the one who is holding up progress. And you know what gets me is they're very profitable. We talked to Frank Snyder last night, Secretary Treasurer of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, and look, this is a very profitable hospital. They're in a not-for-profit status, but they're very profitable. So it's these nurses, it's these phlebotomists, it's all the people who work, the mechanics, the maintenance people, all the people who work in this hospital that provide the service. And this is something that we're going to have to be talking about for the next several months, because we're going to hear an awful lot about corporate profits and about, you know, why do CEOs deserve hundreds of millions of dollars in perks and compensation while the people who are creating the wealth, they're the ones who suffer. You know, this morning I turned on one of the, it was like Fox Business or something, and they had this this British guy, and I don't know what his name was, but he was talking to this Andrew Napolitano, and they were just railing on about teachers' unions and the cops, saying, oh well, you know, these teachers get these big pensions and these cops get these big pensions, never a mention of the guy, like the guy who worked for Home Depot, is the CEO of Home Depot. When they fired him, they fired him. He did a horrible job. Profits down, stock price down, everything down, 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 down. They fired him, told him, there's the door, get the you-know-what out, like they would fire anybody. But instead, you know, but being a CEO, as they're, you know, kicking him to the curb, they say, oh, by the way, you know, we feel bad for you. Here's $210 million to go away. Now, I would love to find any worker who, the guy working in the paint aisle, who they canned for, you know, who knows what. I'd like to know what they gave him on the way out the door. I'm sure it wasn't $210 million. So, you know, as we're going down this path, stop and think about this class thing going on. Because what we're seeing right now is class envy. You've got a group of people who are struggling in the working class, looking at other people in the working class who aren't struggling as much. And, you know, I asked the question, you know, how much would it be for you? How much would you go out there, put a uniform on to be a cop? What compensation level do you think is fair? Should we be paying cops minimum wage? Should we be paying teachers minimum wage? Should a cop make more than a guy swinging a hammer? Or should we all have reasonable wages, decent pensions? And they love to pluck out one example. Well, there was a cop. You know, and he was able to take $700,000 out of his pension. What do you say to that while their kid's starving? All of a sudden, Republicans now are, you know, when it comes down to the people taking pensions and state workers getting a reasonable pension, now they're concerned about poor people? Now they're concerned about hungry children? Now they're concerned? After they've done so much to tank this economy and starve our government programs that help people, now they're concerned when it's coming off the backs of someone else. And, you know, as we keep going, you know, as we do on this program, we talk about working people issues. And, you know, I look at what's going on up at the Pocono Medical Center there. Another example of our labor law system. Another example of why we need serious labor law reform. Why we need to have some push to get labor and management back to the table. And that's what that one-day strike yesterday was about. So we'll talk to her about it. Also, Stephen Zarlinga is going to be here. He's the director of the American Monetary Institute. Going to talk about the Fed. You know, Ron Paul's been one of those people out there pushing this idea that we need to abolish the Fed, take back our money system. I agree. You know, these are issues I think conservatives and liberals and independents and I think everybody can agree that we should be controlling our own monetary system. And Mike Fedor, a candidate for Cumberland County Commissioner, is going to be here late in the second hour to talk about his bid for county commissioner. That should be interesting. I don't know if you saw it today in Washington, D.C. It was Reagan fever. Every person who took the podium today at the Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, they kicked off their D.C. Reagan Fest. You know, everybody got their little credentials, and, you know, they ran right in there because they wanted to hear people like Gingrich and Mitt Romney and Rick Sanitarium. They wanted to hear all these people, and they all wanted to hear how wonderful Ronald Reagan was. So it was kind of it was Reagan Fest today. So some of the fun stuff that came out of it, Tricky Ricky did his deal. And if you remember, Santorum gave kind of a shot to Palin, saying that, well, you know, she was too busy to come to this important conservative function because she was out making money taking care of her kids. So Palin had some words back for Tricky Ricky, saying, I will not call him the knuckle-dragging Neanderthal. I'll let his wife do that instead. And the first thing I said, well, I don't think his wife can because, you know, she's four steps behind him. Because that's kind of that evangelical mentality that we seem to want to put them in the back seat. So I don't think that's going to happen. But anyway, you had this big gathering of really wide-eyed young people that we saw the other day who were just, you know, like, it was almost like they were zombies. They were these hyped-up, caffeinated zombies who were just bouncing around and they were doing cheers, and it was so amazing. I get a kick out of one of the guy who's the head of the conservative group, Citizens United. His name's David Bozy. He said that all of the 15 candidates on their straw ballot, because, you know, every year they come out with a straw ballot, who's going to be their, you know, their nominee. And there are 15 of them this time around. And I love what the guy said about it. He said they're all virtually identical on the big issues, the big global issues that conservatives care about. They're all pro-life. They're all for smaller government. They're all for lower taxes. They're all for a strong national security. They're all pro-military. It's like they're all cookie cutter. They're all the same. Michelle Bachmann, you know, leads the list. You know, a lot of people think the crazy woman's going to take over there. And, you know, when she gave her speech today, it was,
oh, yeah, baby. Oh, yeah, baby.
And I love what she said about free markets. This is kind of a cheerleader moment.
Free markets work. Let them.
Free markets work. You know, how'd that Wall Street thing work out? How's that globalization working out? You know, how'd that, how'd those derivatives work out? Oh yeah, they didn't. They didn't. Of course, also on the ballot is the quitter governor from Alaska, Sarah Palin, who was not in attendance at the event, and ex-governor Mike Huckabee, he's not at the thing. John Thune, senator from South Dakota, he's on the ballot, and a bunch of other cookie-cutter governors like Haley Barbour from Mississippi, Chris Christie from New Jersey, Mitch Daniels from Indiana, Huntsman from Utah, Johnson from New Mexico, Palente from Minnesota, and, of course, Romney, who Romney's the interesting one. Back in 2009 when he was writing his book, what's kind of funny is he had this very middle-of-the-road argument kind of stuff, kind of nuanced, kind of rational. But when he rewrote it for the paperback, total T. He went to the extreme right. And, you know, what's funny about it is I don't think any of the conservatives in the room would know the difference. Oh, it's a new book. Hey, he came out with a new book. But all he did was change a bunch of passages. Ron Paul was there today, I believe. Gingrich was there speaking, sanatorium. Of course, those are other presidential candidates, as well as Herman Cain, who's a talk show host and former CEO of Godfather's Pizza. And I'm going, I'm in favor of Cain. I think Cain's not a bad idea. Pizza for everybody. I go back to that Fast Times at Ridgemont High, you know, ordering pizza in the classroom. What the heck? Pizza for everybody. And, of course, the Donald was there. Our apprentice billionaire, Donald Trump, he's now, I guess, a Democrat. So, I guess he's a Republican now. He used to be a Democrat, right, I think. Now he's a Republican, jumping into the crazy conservative political action conference, telling them that if he runs, and wins, of course, that America will be respected again. And, I keep thinking, is this what the country has fallen to? Is this what we've become? We've got to turn to a reality TV show for a candidate. Personally, I think like Palin, this is a stunt. Again, you got to give the Donald credit. He knows how to turn a photo op. He knows how to turn a situation to benefit him. After all, I mean, this is a guy who's probably had as many bankruptcies as Joan Rivers had facelifts. So, but he's never personally, and this is maybe this is the guy we need. And I was thinking about this today. Maybe the guy we need here is someone like the Donald, who has filed bankruptcy, who knows how many times, only on the corporate side. He's a billionaire because he protects his own assets. He protects his hide. So I start thinking about the Donald and say, well, why don't we just rename the U.S. the Donald and say, the Donald, why don't you protect our country like you've protected yourself? Insulate the country as you have yourself. So you have all these business losses, no big deal. The taxpayers will pick that up. But you personally, you do all right. And it brings me back to this idea of protectionism. We protect what's ours, protect our nation. I don't want to be isolationist. I don't want to isolate ourselves. But protect the home, just like the Donald protects his home. Doesn't that make some sense on some level? Now, personally, I don't think he's running. I honestly don't. But it's a nice exposure. It's a nice way to put some money in his pocket and promote the show, The Apprentice, which I'm sure he mentioned a number of times. And I go back to this thing yesterday, and I can't get this guy out of my head, this Tim Minnery or Tom Minnery. I just can't get this statement about poverty being trendy out of my head, and that the most efficient way to deal with poverty, according to the focus on destroying the family people, is for husbands and wives to love each other. That's it. It's almost as good as when the Republicans repealed health care in the House and said, we're going to replace it with common sense. Am I missing something here? Is this the way we go? I got to tell you, folks, it's going to be an interesting year and a half until the next election cycle happens. It's going to be very entertaining, and we're going to be right here to enjoy it with you. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Jessica Irving, phlebotomist at the Pocono Medical Center. Stick around after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. A coalition of union members, religious leaders, community activists, and farm workers are pressing J.P. Morgan Chase to declare a full one-year moratorium on home foreclosures. Last week, this coalition protested at 200 J.P. Morgan Chase bank branches nationwide. Chase has at least $19.5 billion in homes in foreclosure. The activists are also asking Chase to use its influence as the chief lender to R.J. Reynolds to improve the living and working conditions of farm workers who harvest the tobacco that goes into R.J. Reynolds' products. Brandon Rees is deputy director of the AFL-CIO's Office of Investment.
We believe that both J.P. Morgan Chase as well as Reynolds American are in a position to help those farm workers to improve their living standards and also to protect them from health and safety violations, subminimum wages that are all too commonplace in migrant farm worker communities today. What we've called on J.P. Morgan Chase to do is to institute a one-year moratorium, in fact, to hold that moratorium until a group of independent community leaders can meet with the bank, review their foreclosure process, and make sure that J.P. Morgan Chase is not violating the rights of homeowners.
A judge has reversed former D.C. schools chancellor Michelle Rees' decision to fire 75 teachers in 2008. Jesse Russell reports.
In 2008, 75 teachers were fired during their probationary period by former D.C. schools chancellor Michelle Rees. On Monday, a ruling reversed Rees' decision to fire those teachers, ruling that the chancellor had not given a reason to justify their termination. During the 3.5 years Rees was chancellor of the troubled school system, she eliminated nearly 1,000 teachers. 200 were let go in October of 2009 alone for poor performance. The remaining teachers were fired as part of their 2-year probation. The school district now has 60 days to try to find a new position for those teachers, and they must be reimbursed for pay lost after being fired. The Washington Teachers Union has said that it could cost Washington, D.C. school district more than $7 million. Rees has since moved on to become an education advisor for Florida's Republican Governor Rick Scott. This is the second bad press week for Rees, who was slammed by former math teacher turned blogger Guy Bradenburg earlier this month for possibly inflating her own performance numbers as a math teacher. Brandenburg concluded that if Rees had been subjected to the same evaluation she implemented in the school district, she would have put her own job on the chopping block.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith. Come on.
That is the question. That is the question in anything you'll do in life. What side of the issue are you on? And when it comes down to being in the workplace, which side are you on when it comes to management labor? So yesterday afternoon, workers at the Pocono Medical Center in Monroe County were on the picket line in the bitter cold to draw attention to management's refusal to recognize their right to union representation. Pocono Medical Center employees are represented by SEIU Healthcare PA, and they took to the picket line for a one-day unfair labor practice strike. They have been fighting for a contract since September. That tells me we've got a problem with our labor law in this country. Jessica Irvine is one of those workers who was on the picket line. Jessica, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thank you very much.
Can you give me the overall situation? How did you get to yesterday's action?
Okay, well, it started back in the fall. We kind of reached an impasse during negotiations. There were some people that wanted an open shop. Most of us wanted a closed shop. So it was decided to have an election. And this election was set up by the National Labor Relations Board, so it was a legal election. And the result of the election, it was overwhelming in favor of a strong union. And management has since totally disregarded, you know, the results of that election.
Now, do you currently have a contract, or would this be your first contract?
We had a contract which expired October 31st. So we've been working under the old contract. We don't really have a new contract right now. And right now negotiations seem to be at a standstill. And, you know, even though we've gotten a lot of community support, we've gotten letters from Senator Casey, Senator Yudichak, different representatives in the area, different unions in the area, and they just refuse to budge and accept the result of our election.
So,
we issued a complaint. In fact, the National Labor Relations Board issued a complaint against PFC for interfering with employees' rights and for the hospital refusing to honor the results of an NLRB certified election.
So the result then, October your contract ended. You've been at wanting to be at the bargaining table to reach an agreement. They've refused, led you to yesterday. Tell me what happened yesterday.
Well, yesterday we had about an 80% participation. 80% of the people that, you know, are in our union, the SEIU, went outside in the freezing cold and marching up and down the street and trying to reach out to the community. Basically, we're upset because management doesn't seem willing to come to the table and bargain in good faith. It seems like they have a set agenda, and actually we're really kind of puzzled why they can't just accept the results of the election. It doesn't cost them anything. There's no fiscal obligation involved in permitting us to have a strong voice. And it's just very frustrating, and we felt we had no other choice but to, come to the conclusion of having a one-day strike. It was a very painful and difficult decision to come to because we all care about our jobs and our patients very much. And it wasn't easy for a lot of people, of course, to give up a day's pay, but this is how strongly we feel about the situation. I've always been raised that when you vote, you are making, a silent agreement when you vote to abide by the result of the vote, any vote. And I just don't understand how they think that, they don't have to pay. I mean, elections are the American way. Well, and we just feel that, management shouldn't be allowed to overlook the results of our vote.
Yeah, and you would think in this country that we would have solved this already. And this shows the glaring failure of our labor law and the fact that we need labor law reform desperately. We're not going to get it here in the next 2 years because we have we've got a Republican-controlled House of Representatives who will not allow that to happen. But this is a glaring fact of why we need labor law reform. Now, looking at what happened yesterday, are you seeing anything different from management? Have there been any new scheduled talks, anything, or is this just going to let this roll off?
As far as I know, I don't believe that any new talks have been scheduled. I have not heard from anyone. Another thing I would like to point out is the intimidation level gets progressively worse as we continue in our struggle. I would say for like the week before the strike, there was a lot of intimidation going on. This is one of the complaints that the National Labor Relations Board has filed against PMC, to the point they were even trying to control our conversation on our own time, on our break time, on our lunch time. They didn't want us discussing these issues even on our own time as long as we were on the premises. And, of course, that's really unfair. a lot of people were frightened to go out on strike because they were told they would face disciplinary action. Some people were told that they would not have health insurance. And then they also started a rumor that for the people that, for their own personal reasons, that felt they had to cross the picket line, that they would be fined. And all those things are lies. That's just not true.
But it's what they get away with.
And
it's
yeah,
the shame,
exactly.
Again, going back to the premise that our labor law is broken in this country, that you can have that type of intimidation. And we know that in most organizing campaigns, this stuff happens. We know that people are fired needlessly to set an example. We know this stuff. And yet the workers in this country, for some odd reason, we still elect politicians who allow the status quo. It's mind-boggling to me, Jessica.
Well, it's mind-boggling to me, too, at least me. And it's very frustrating. It really is. I mean, everybody works hard. We really do. And I think a lot of times when people think of unions, they think of big money, and that's not the case here. I mean, the average salary of the person that was out striking yesterday is $22,000 a year. So you know we have to love our jobs because we go in day after day, do the best job that we can, and it just doesn't seem fair that they're not even willing to compromise in any way on this issue.
I got to tell you, Jessica, you know, I know a lot of nurses, and I've talked to a lot of nurses over the years who they have that commitment to their job, and it's really not about the money.
No, it's not.
It's about having that voice, having the ability to stand up and say, you know, I think this is wrong for the patient, being able to be part of the equation. And that's, you know, to me, an important thing. And I would think as an employer, I would want my skilled staff, I would want my highly trained people to have some input to help save me if something were to happen.
Well, you certainly would think so. And I definitely think that this is why we voted to have a strong union, because we want to keep stability and security, you know, in the workplace. I mean, and especially right now in these economic times, and people are always afraid, you know, of losing their job or for whatever reason. And, you know, it's a scary, scary world out there right now. And it's difficult for, I think, a lot of working class people just to make ends meet and to not have a voice or a say in how they're treated, I feel, is just really wrong.
I want to go back to the intimidation and then the threats that you were talking about a minute ago. Have you personally, Jessica, had any of this heavy-handedness by management?
I have not personally. We were encouraged to sign papers.
What kind of papers?
Well, it's a paper. You can sign this paper and send it into the union, stating that you just want to be a fair core, what they call a fair core member. And what that does is it reduces your dues. So you pay less dues. You're only paying like 80% dues. But by the same token, you lose your voice. I mean, if you're a fair core member, you are not allowed to vote in any of the elections. And a lot of people were told that if they signed that paper, they would not be fined if they walked the picket line, crossed the picket line. And a lot of people, I think, you know, were afraid of being fined, and they signed the paper.
Oh,
and
my
to
gosh.
Me, it's kind of like a backdoor runaround to, you know, weaken us and push for, you know, an open shop.
You know, 100 years ago, we said yellow dog contracts were illegal. Yet what you're telling me sounds just like that. Sounds like we've gone back 100 years in labor in this country. Absolutely amazing to me.
It is a little scary to me, too. I mean, you know, like as a citizen who, you know, like believes in the vote and the democratic process, it just seems that, you know, we've been violated on this issue.
So let me ask you, where do we go from here? Yesterday you had the action. If nothing happens in a month, two, three, five, what's next?
Well, we will probably have a meeting sometime next week to discuss the next step. I know, as I said before, we have been in contact with some of the state senators and representatives, and we certainly have a lot of support from a lot of the unions in the area, and, you know, see what we can do next to make them realize that we're not going away. We're not going away. We have the right to fight.
Stand strong, Jessica. One day more. That's all you got to think about is one day more. Let me know what happens because we want to be a part of this. And if this if you have another action, we want to be there.
Thank you very much. That would really mean a lot to a lot of people.
Jessica Irvine, I appreciate your time. Please keep me informed.
I will.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
Covering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
This new Republican-run House of Representatives is looking a lot like the old Ethics Be Damned House run just a few years ago by the convicted money launderer Tom DeLay, only more so. Back when DeLay was the GOP's corrupt majority leader, he got caught hustling campaign funds from an energy corporation whose legislation he then helped pass. This flagrant cash-for-legislation exchange was so stinky that even DeLay's pals on the Ethics Committee had to slap his wrist, ruling in 2004 that a Congress critter should not engage in fundraising, quote, that gives even an appearance that donors will receive special treatment. Now, fast forward to last year, when the independent investigative arm of the House Ethics Committee charged two Republicans and one Democrat with DeLay-style money hustles. The investigators found compelling proof that these powerful members collected checks from Wall Street lobbyists just before voting their way on regulatory reforms. Emails and other incriminating documents show that one of the eager check collectors even left the Capitol while the House was debating the reforms so he could attend the fundraiser being thrown for him at a lobbyist's home. He then returned to the floor to vote against the reforms exactly as his grinning Wall Street donors wanted. The punishment for these miscreants? None. In one of its first acts this year, the new Ethics Committee merrily dropped all charges against their delighted colleagues. In an Alice in Wonderland moment, the committee declared on January 26 that there was no connection between the vote and the cash, adding that no, quote, reasonable person would see even an appearance of impropriety in the exchange. This is Jim Hightower saying, excuse me for being unreasonable, but it appears obvious that what the committee has done is to set an ethical standard for this Congress that's even lower the dark days of Tom DeLay.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Gasoline, groceries, and our hate is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is.
Boy, if that isn't the truth. Everything does seem to be going up, but the wages. And I look at this story from New York. Walmart's lengthy struggle to open up New York City evidently has hit fresh problems. A new controversial report is out, and it is saying that America's biggest discounter doesn't sell just cheap stuff. It makes neighborhoods poorer. The report concludes that Walmart, the biggest U.S. private employer, kills jobs rather than creates them, drives down wages, and is a tax burden for everyone in the community because, you know what, they don't give their people health care half the time. Their part-time folks end up getting medical assistance. They end up getting food stamps. They end up getting LIHEAP. They end up getting all of these programs. And Walmart pockets the change. They pocket the wages that they should have been paying to their workers, which is why I'm a big fan in allowing them to organize. You know, going back to the last segment, you know, you create a middle class by creating people who can afford to buy things and people who can have money in their pocket because the wages they earn are sufficient. New York City Council will hold a public hearing on this, on the impact Walmart will have, but the retailer declined to show up. Walmart has dismissed the critical report, saying that, oh, you know what? They've just randomly selected statements from flawed studies. But the report is based on 50 studies of Walmart openings and comes as the company tries to gain the foothold into New York's poorest neighborhoods. You know, they chose to go into places like Brooklyn. They chose to go into places like Brownville, East New York, where the census data shows that median income for the family in East New York is like 33 grand. In Brownsville is about 26, where the rest of the income in New York City is about 56 grand. So you're looking at a big discrepancy in income. And, you know, you may bring some jobs there, but are they going to cost the rest of the neighborhood more jobs along with it? That's the other part of this. But Walmart's smart. They're not going to go down without a fight. So they're going to these poor communities saying, you know what, we're going to just kind of sneak our way in. And once we get that toe in the water, then they'll be able to break open that egg. And, you know, for years now, we've been talking about Walmart. And look, from a business standpoint, in a free market economy, they are the smartest guy on the block. They've figured out how to do supply chains. They've figured out how to have just-in-time inventory. They've figured out how to make the machine run. They've also figured out how to suppress wages. They've also figured out how to exploit their workforce and exploit situations in poor places where you can get people who are just grateful to have a job to do whatever it is they want them to do. And we've seen stories across this country of Walmart locking people into their stores to make them clean overnight. We've seen them making people work through breaks and punching them out while people are still working. All of this wage theft has been going on. There have been numerous lawsuits. And yet, you look at them saying, you know what, we just want to go into New York so we can offer people, you know, better prices, better living. And I love what their spokesman said. We're going to bring good jobs and good shopping for fresh food to locals. Uh-huh. They're the organic people now, huh? And you look in Chicago, where last year Walmart, they were able to build two stores because the unions agreed. Personally, I got to look at that and go, you know, do we really want the evil empire expanding even more? I'm a big fan of local. I'm a big fan of regional. I'm a big fan of saying, you know, when I was a kid, for instance, my grandmother worked at a Walmart type store. It was called Uncle Bill's, and there were a bunch of them in Cleveland. There was Cook's, there was Zehrs, there was Clarkins. There were a bunch of these little department stores, and they competed against each other. They all had, you know, different products, and it was a much better scenario. And you know, those workers, they made a decent living. My grandmother, back in 1985 when she retired, was making $8 an hour. She was getting six weeks vacation, full medical, full dental, full eye, and a retirement package. What are they making over at Walmart today, 25 years, 26 years later? I would say not much more than $8 an hour. I would guarantee they're not getting 6 weeks vacation. I would guarantee they're not getting the health benefits and the vision and the prescription and all the dental and all the other stuff that UFCW Local 880 in Cleveland provided for their workers. I guarantee you they're not getting the pension that my grandmother's getting. Why? Well, because Walmart came to town and destroyed all of those stores. So all of those jobs that used to be there, all of those family-sustaining jobs, because understand, most of the women that my grandmother worked with were single mothers. Most of them were providing for their children. And you go to the Walmart today, and who are they? Mostly single mothers who are trying to make ends meet. So the question I guess I have for you, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, is having a Walmart in your neighborhood a good thing? Is this what we want? Is this the kind of economy we want? Especially considering the fact that you look at the reality that everything that that they want to buy has to come from China. You know, the Vlasic pickle story is an amazing story. They basically destroyed Vlasic pickle by saying, look, you have to sell us a gallon-sized monster jar at the same price that you sell that little one in the supermarket. Now, look, nobody eats those monster-sized jars full of pickles, but people buy them because, oh, they're cheap. And they do that with every single product. You know, Huffy bicycles used to be made in Ohio, made in China. You go down the list, and I'll show you somewhere where Walmart pushed for it. You know, when Jake talks about Hershey chocolate, you know, he's saying, look, they were trying to push Hershey to make their chocolate elsewhere. And I keep going back to this. You know, is this a good scenario? Is this what we want? Is this the kind of economy we want? Where we push all of our manufacturing, we push all of our production out of the country so that we can buy a basket full of cheap stuff. And it comes back down to the question, are we workers first or are we consumers first? Because that's what I look at. You know, first, I'm a worker. I had to earn my money first before I could spend it. So I'm going to look for things that are going to increase employment here. And if you remember, you know, Walmart for a while, they were playing to that. Oh, made in America stuff everywhere, even though they really weren't. It's amazing stuff. Our quote of the day comes from David Bonnier, chair of the American Rights at Work and a former congressman from Michigan. He says, the China trade deal is basically like the Bobby Knight of trade deals. You know, you abuse, and then they say, well, okay, we'll let you try it just one more time. That's kind of true with what we've been seeing coming out of China. You remember last night we were talking about how the House Republicans once again were screwing workers who get kicked to the curb by their globalization schemes because they wouldn't sign off on the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program. They postponed that again. Well, today, and I want to see how this happens. I want to see how the Republicans screw this up. Today, Currency Reform and Fair Trade Act. This was introduced by Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio and Olympia Snow of Maine. Also, Representatives Sanders Levin of Michigan and Tim Murphy of Pennsylvania, and also Tim Ryan of Ohio. This is the same piece of legislation that last year, in September, the U.S. House passed 348-79. Now, understand, it was bipartisan, seemed pretty bipartisan, but understand, that was an election year. So it's going to be interesting to see how they block this and how they screw this up, because understand, the lobbying money is coming in. The lobbyists are pushing hard to keep the trade deals as they are because multinationals are doing very well. Walmart's doing very well because the Chinese government are getting away with manipulating their currency, and they're not going to stop. They're not going to stop until you stop them. That's it, period. There's no, oh, you're right, we got caught. No, they're going to keep doing it until somebody puts their foot on them and says no more. We've lost millions of manufacturing jobs in this country, and our middle class is dying because they're cheating. We're allowing them. We're giving it to them. And that's the thing that bothers me. It's not like we're losing the manufacturing fight. It's not like we're less innovative. It's not like we're less productive. It is that we're giving it away. And this currency manipulation just distorts our trade. And it makes our trade deficits unsustainable. We cannot continue. And it's killing this nation. You want to talk about a massive redistribution of wealth? This is it. And I'll tell you, you want to create jobs there, T-Twits? Here is the issue of the day. Forget Obamacare. Forget that pro-birth nonsense. Forget your zealotry over who can marry who. And stop showing your true colors when it comes to family values, because we know you don't have any. Create jobs. That's what you're supposed to do. Do it. And this is how it's done. Stop letting them get away with this. We're going to take a break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Anthony, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make it happen. We make it happen.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Our Borowitz Report, in an effort to show that they are serious about reducing the size of the federal deficit, a group of House Republicans announced today that they would totally eliminate shirts for this year's congressional budget. Lawmakers who call themselves the Shirtless Republicans and are led by Representative Christopher Lee, appeared in the Capitol Rotunda this morning naked from the waist up. We're going to slash this budget until it's ripped and shredded as my abs, Christopher Lee said. Representative Lee added that in order to postpone their eligibility for Social Security, the shirtless Republicans would also subtract 7 years from their stated ages. Immediately after the appearance, a spokesman for C-SPAN said that the network would immediately pull the plug on all future broadcasts from the House of Representatives, saying, "We don't think the American people should have to see this." Yeah. So you remember yesterday we talked about this Republican congressman from New York who just up and resigned after, you know, someone sent a photo of him, you know, shirtless to this woman on Craigslist. He said he was, you know, like 39. He's actually 46. Said he was divorced, and he still may be. But at the time, he now, as I know, he's still married. said he was profoundly, sorry for his mistakes and the whole nine yards. And my thought was, you know, okay, so you got caught sending a picture around. You made a couple of dumb emails. Come on. Republicans have done far worse than that. I mean, David Vitter, Dapper Dan there, Diaper Dave, with his diaper story. That is far worse than sending one of those snapshots in the mirror. Far, far worse. At least I think. Larry Craig, the Mr. Wide Stance. I think that's far worse. John Ensign, I think, paying off your mistress to be quiet. I think that's far worse. This was just a couple of emails. So what could it be? They're saying that our good congressman could have done a bunch more. In fact, Jonathan Weissman, a Wall Street Journal reporter, said on Twitter, backstory on Chris Lee gonna be juicy. Lots of reporters were chasing his extra affairs there in the fall. He said, but none of them could break the story. I'm thinking we're going to start seeing the floodgates open. You remember Mark Foley? We talked about him last night, the guy who, it was just innocent, texting and innocent instant messaging, to this 15-year-old boy, asking him for, photos of himself. At first, it was just one thing. But as the story develops, as people go, oh, yeah, he did that to me. This could get interesting. And Politico's Jake Sherman and John Brenshahan reported today that Lee was among a group of GOP lawmakers that Father John Boehner allegedly warned to, quote, knock it off in regard to his partying with female lobbyists. So it's kind of be interesting, going to be interesting as we move forward in this, because we all love a good scandal. And, while everything's going on in Egypt, while everything's going on around the globe and people are out of work, we're going to talk about shirtless Chris. And I've already done it for about 6 minutes now while people are struggling. But here again, you look at the reality, and these folks are hypocritical. These are the family values folks who, like I said earlier, they don't have value. They don't have these values. And again, like I said last night, I don't care what they do. I care what kind of policy they put forth. And now all of this is a distraction from what they should be doing, creating jobs, pure and simple. Another story of conservatives being conservatives. I don't know if you saw this down in Mississippi. They're looking at honoring the Confederate General Nathan Buford Forrest with his very own license plate. So they're the Mississippi Division of the Sons of the Confederate Veterans. They're proposing a license plate to honor him. The only problem is he was the early leader of the Ku Klux Klan. And I think it's kind of funny in a way that we're still having these fights. And I got to be honest, the more you think about this stuff, the more I do believe there are some people who would get that just to poke, just to stir things up, and for no good reason. And again, it's another one of these distractions at a time when we can least afford it. And as I look at what's happened since the election, nothing has moved us forward on the job front. There have been no policies put forward. There's been no direction. These cuts that they keep talking about are in my mind, punitive. They're poorly targeted. They're harmful, yet they're ideological. And, it's this ideology, this bizarre split that while one party takes over, it's about punishing the other. So what we're seeing now is the Republicans feel emboldened to turn around and punish the Democrats. And it's not even about you and me anymore. It's about punishing each other's each other's funders or each other's base. It's not about the country. You know, I look at some of these bizarre rules that are popping up. Like we talked about Scott Perry's nonsensical little rule that, oh, we're going to mandate secret ballot elections, even though he knows you can't do it. Because it's the federal government's responsibility to oversee this. They know it's not going to, it's going to do nothing but cause divisiveness. It's going to do nothing but cost us money when we can ill afford it. But it's about ideology. It's about punishing those political enemies. And I didn't see the Democrats do that to the extent that I see Republicans doing. And again, it's this scorched earth mentality. It's this very Machiavellian view of politic that you destroy your enemy and scorch everything behind it. And that's what we're seeing. Some of the very angry legislation coming out. And when this immigration discussion starts coming up, because it's going to come back up, it has to. The federal government has to do something with our immigration policy. We need to secure our southern border. We absolutely need to, but we need to have people coming in because we have an upside down demographic. We need young people coming in to take care of our old people. That's just a reality. But like the TV show I saw this morning for a couple of minutes, because I actually found current TV, they had a special on people crossing the border and how the coyotes take you across the border, and you know it's a dangerous game. And I say, you know, at some point, don't we have to look at this and say, you know what, we want people coming to the U.S. who want to be citizens, and they want to work hard, and they want to get ahead, because we need them. And while when we talk about manufacturing jobs, had we kept all those manufacturing jobs here, we couldn't find people for them all. We do need people coming in. We need the brain trust to come in. We need skilled people to come in. As well as low paid workers to help do the the snot wiping jobs, because as our baby boomers grow older, there aren't enough grandchildren around to wipe all their noses. Anyway, that's kind of where we're going today. We come back from the break. Stephen Zarlinga, director of the American Monetary Institute, is going to be here talking about the Fed. And if you saw, you know, Ron Paul, one of the guys that one of the things I agree with him on, and there's a couple of things, is this idea that we need to get rid of the Fed. We need to nationalize our money. You know, most people think that, you know, most people that I've met think the federal government issues the money. They see Federal Reserve note. They think, hey, it's federal money. It's not. This really bizarre, and he's going to explain this a little bit better than I can. This Federal Reserve is kind of it's a private thing, but there's some public interest in it. It's kind of troublesome. And when the Fed has the kind of power to do the things that they've done throughout the years, to move the economy one way or another, to allow the wealthy to the big bankers to do some of the things that they do, you got to question. Where's all this money going? Where's all that TARP money? Where is that? How was that spent? We have no idea. We have no accountability because it was a very hasty thing. It was a very short-written bill. So it'll be interesting to talk to Stephen Zarlinga about that. Again, he's the director of the American Monetary Institute. So that'll be interesting. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you missed any portion of the program, you can go to thericksmithshow.com. Click on it. It's right there for you to download the podcast. You can also watch the video. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with Stephen Zarlinga. Stick around.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. A coalition of union members, religious leaders, community activists, and farm workers are pressing J.P. Morgan Chase to declare a full one-year moratorium on home foreclosures. Last week, this coalition protested at 200 J.P. Morgan Chase bank branches nationwide. Chase has at least $19.5 billion in homes in foreclosure. The activists are also asking Chase to use its influence as the chief lender to R.J. Reynolds to improve the living and working conditions of farm workers who harvest the tobacco that goes into R.J. Reynolds products. Brandon Rees is deputy director of the AFL-CIO's Office of Investment.
We believe that both J.P. Morgan Chase as well as Reynolds American are in a position to help those farm workers to improve their living standards and also to protect them from health and safety violations, subminimum wages that are all too commonplace in migrant farm worker communities today. What we've called on J.P. Morgan Chase to do is to institute a one-year moratorium, in fact, a hold that moratorium until a group of independent community leaders can meet with the bank, review their foreclosure process, and make sure that J.P. Morgan Chase is not violating the rights of homeowners.
A judge has reversed former D.C. schools chancellor Michelle Rees's decision to fire 75 teachers in 2008. Jesse Russell reports.
In 2008, 75 teachers were fired during their probationary period by former D.C. schools chancellor Michelle Rees. On Monday, a ruling reversed Rees's decision to fire those teachers, ruling that the chancellor had not given a reason to justify their termination. During the 3.5 years Rees was chancellor of the troubled school system, she eliminated nearly 1,000 teachers. 200 were let go in October of 2009 alone for poor performance. The remaining teachers were fired as part of their 2-year probation. The school district now has 60 days to try to find a new position for those teachers, and they must be reimbursed for pay lost after being fired. The Washington Teachers Union has said that it could cost Washington, D.C. school district more than $7 million. Rees has since moved on to become an education advisor for Florida's Republican Governor Rick Scott. This is the second bad press week for Rees, who was slammed by former math teacher turned blogger Guy Bradenburg earlier this month for possibly inflating her own performance numbers as a math teacher. Brandenburg concluded that if Rees had been subjected to the same evaluation she implemented in the school district, she would have put her own job on the chopping block.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. During the State of the Union address, the president laid out what I think were several very good ideas on how to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure and invest in our future needs while putting people back to work. The only problem is we can't continue to borrow forever, and our Republican friends feel they have been given this mandate to starve the government and really to make some very draconian cuts, some of them in investment. Many believe the problems we face can be solved by abolishing the Federal Reserve and ending the fractional banking structure that has allowed big banks to overextend. Ron Paul being one of them. I've got Stephen Zarlinga, director of the American Monetary Institute, on the phone. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you, Rick. Thanks very much. Good to be here.
You know, I look at this argument about the Fed, and there's a lot of information out there on either side. Some say we need to abolish it. We need to take back our money. I kind of tend to agree with that. Where is your position?
Well, that's a good question. I've been studying this for a long, long time. I was involved in financial markets for about 30 years, and began intensive research in 1990, was a co-founder of the American Monetary Institute in 1996, and my book was published, it's called The Lost Science of Money, in 2003. And we have a good idea of what has to be done, and it comes from historical case studies of what has happened in the past, and we go all the way back to Aristotle's time, 4th century B.C., and we've figured out what has to be done.
Okay, so what has to be done?
Well, first, okay, I'll sum it up immediately and then tell you all the reasons for it, okay?
Okay.
Here's what has to be done today to fix the system. And first, you have to realize that you are in a war. We are all in a war. And if they say, "Oh, you're starting up class warfare," no, we're just recognizing it.
We're just fighting back. I agree.
It's there, and it's deadly. And I mean, people are dying as a result of it. And I can give you plenty of examples.
Well, I think the fact that, you know, we have all these people every year who don't have health care, and they die because of lack of health care, I think that's a good example.
Yeah, I know. And it happens at various levels. People are dying because they can't replace old, worn-out tires on their cars.
Excellent point.
People are dying because they can't see the faded white line or yellow line in the middle of the street at night when it's raining, when a truck is coming the other direction. They don't know exactly where they are. People are dying all the time because of the way the money system is being mismanaged. And for what purpose is that happening? It's being mismanaged in order to concentrate more and more wealth in the hands of people who, I like to say, criminally oriented. In fact, they have fixed the laws so that technically they're not criminal. Morally, they certainly are.
I agree with you.
And until we fight back, first you got to understand what's going on. If you don't understand what's going on, you're going to be helpless.
So help me understand.
Okay. Where do I start? How much time do we have? Never mind. I'll just start.
We got 9 minutes in this segment and 12 in the next.
Very good.
Hit me.
Okay. This war, we can trace the war back to the time of Aristotle. And it's fought over the definition of money. What is the concept of money? Mankind has tended to misdefine money, enabling those who are in control to establish their control. Now, some people think money has to be a commodity. But if money is a commodity, then you are turning money into, you are insisting that money be wealth. And if that's the case, you are handing the control of the money system over to the wealthy. And it does not belong in the hands of any group. It belongs to the whole society. If you want to define or misdefine money as credit, which is what we do at present, then you've turned the control of the money system over to the banking people, because they're the ones that will dominate in credit.
Which is what we've done.
We've done that, we've got that, and we see the example of it. It brought the whole world down.
Yeah, instead of raising wages, we saw raising credit limits.
And interest rates, and madness, and total madness. It boggles the mind that humanity can be put into this kind of situation, because it now threatens the existence of the species. It's that serious. Same people controlling the money system, controlling the weapons. You cannot trust that they're going to control it any better than they controlled the money, miscontrolled the money system. Aristotle gave us the nature of money. He told us money exists not by nature, but by law. So he has properly defined money as an institution of the law, an abstract power of society. And if you define money in that way correctly, as, by the way, our American Constitution does that,
right,
then you can have the monetary system function for the good of all, to promote the general welfare.
So why don't we control our money? Why do we have this Federal Reserve?
In our own case, through a couple of centuries of mismanagement, right from the start, the Constitutional Convention did not handle the money question adequately. They met from, I think, May through September. He didn't really start to consider money until the middle of August. and they did not do a full enough job. And we're facing a very clever, powerful adversary with the ability to control and create money in our system, and they've used that power to buy our legislators. So our act does three things. We promote three things, and I must say at the beginning, Congressman Dennis Kucinich introduced the act which contains all of our monetary reform points on December 17th in the last Congress.
Right, the NEED Act, the National Emergency Employment.
You know about it.
Defense,
yeah, the NEED Act.
Sure.
Now, the NEED Act does these three main things. It nationalizes the Federal Reserve System, or you could say it incorporates it into the U.S. Treasury. That's the first thing it does.
Okay.
That's huge.
Absolutely.
Now, everybody, not everybody, but a lot of people think that it's already in our government.
No, it's the Fed's a private corporation.
Yeah, it's got, it has, there's a little bit of ambiguity because the president does appoint the chairman, and he appoints members of the board, the Washington board, but they're appointed for 14-year periods. That only happens once. There's no control once they're appointed.
Right.
There's no continuing. Now, all new money is then created by the U.S. government as the Constitution empowers it to do Article 1, Section 8. Now, that alone would not work. That wouldn't be enough. That would be progress, but it wouldn't be enough. We know that because the Bank of England was nationalized in 1946 at the request, by way of the Archbishop of Canterbury. Oh, I should mention, all of this is in my book. It's called The Lost Science of Money, and all of your people can find a description of this. They can find a description of what Congressman Kucinich put in at our website, which is at monetary.org. And they're invited to do that, and we can send them a free CD if they simply send us an email from the website saying free CD with their mailing address. We'll mail them a CD.
All right. We'll make sure we get a link to that on our website at thericksmithshow.com.
Excellent. Thank you. So, as I was saying, just nationalizing the Federal Reserve is not enough. The Brits nationalized the Bank of England in 1946, and at that point in time, about half British money was created by the government through the nationalized Bank of England, but they allowed the private banks to continue to create money, to continue to use what's called the fractional reserve system, which is the way in which they create money, basically. So at that point in time, half the money was Brit created, half the money was private bank created. That, at that point, they got all these great things. They got their national health care. They got wonderful social programs that they love.
Because they were in control of their money.
Half. And what happened is, in the meantime, the bankers ended up controlling more and more and more because they knew what they wanted to do. Today, British money is 97% bank created and 3% government created, same as here. So that tells us, Rick, that not only do you need to nationalize the national bank, you must stop the private banks from creating money. You must remove the accounting privilege that they have, whereby they are the creators of money, of what we use for money. And that's what the second part of the NEED Act does. And that is, banks may no longer create what we use for money through what's known as the fractional reserve system. It's
right.
Ended. No more bank-created money. Okay.
Now, what would you say to the person who would say, well, if we can't do that, then we can't make loans?
Oh, they can make loans. They just have to loan money, not credit. Right now, they're not even loaning money. What they loan is their promise to pay money. It's credit.
Right, but, you know, there are some who would argue that by stopping that, you would stop growth.
Well, you don't. It doesn't work that way because all the money that's still in existence continues to be in existence. That doesn't go out of existence. And they can loan that if it's in their account, if it's in the bank as a deposit where the depositor allows them to loan the money. Can you bring that back after I mention the third part?
Please, go ahead.
Okay. If you just did those two parts, nationalize the Fed, banks no longer create money, you would, in all likelihood, create a deflation. And again, we know this from historical cases. So the third part of the act, and the important part from the point of view of labor, I think, the government then is enabled to create the money and spend it into circulation, for example, on infrastructure. And you'd start with the $2.2 trillion that the engineers tell us you've got to have just to make our present infrastructure, bridges, dams, and so on, safe.
Right.
They're not safe. One in 10 dams is in danger of collapse right now. That's 8,000 out of 80,000 dams actually in danger of collapse. I've driven over that bridge in Minneapolis that did collapse. They did not, you know, the existing monetary system didn't fix those things. They haven't kept up the absolute minimum of infrastructure that you need for society to continue. This is an utter condemnation of the existing system. They either couldn't or wouldn't do those things.
I would say wouldn't.
They wouldn't, yeah. Did they fix, you know, we had the warnings on PBS of what would happen in New Orleans if a hurricane hit. And they were
even
worse.
Right.
We knew that for years, and they still wouldn't fix the levees. So
let's bring this to now. How do we fix our current economy? How do we move forward?
You do those three things, and you got it.
Okay, and you talked about deflation.
That's it. Now the infrastructure fixes the jobs problem.
Okay.
Because of the employment to
right.
fix that stuff. Those are good paying jobs. They're not going to get exported to India or Mexico or any place else.
Unless we import Indians and Mexicans and Chinese.
Well,
and
I think
Chinese.
American labor has to stand up and just say no. You guys used to be tough. I think we've all gotten soft because, you know, things have been easier for us in some ways compared to what they used to be during the great years of the labor fight, where labor attained these rights, which has lifted our society dramatically and helped everybody in our society. So I think we're going to have to come down to facing that. The opposition's tough. They're demanding huge bonuses and getting them simply because they give part of it over to political donations. And too many politicians think that because these guys are riding in limousines and wearing nice clothes that they're respectable. They're not. It's a criminal element, except that the crimes have been legalized, basically. So those three things are all you need to do to start the system rebuilding. It won't, you know, it'll take some years to rebuild, but you'll be on the right track. And it must be done.
Yep.
We're at the point where it has to be done, or we could lose our society.
And if you want to read more about this, the book is The Lost Science of Money.
That's right.
There's a link over at monetary.org.
Monetary.org.
We've got a site at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Stephen, I appreciate your time. Interesting subject.
No questions?
I got to take a break right here.
Okay.
I would love to talk to you again at some point, though.
Very good.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
Defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
This new Republican-run House of Representatives is looking a lot like the old Ethics Be Damned House run just a few years ago by the convicted money launderer Tom DeLay. Only more so. Back when DeLay was the GOP's corrupt majority leader, he got caught hustling campaign funds from an energy corporation whose legislation he then helped pass. This flagrant cash for legislation exchange was so stinky that even DeLay's pals on the Ethics Committee had to slap his wrist, ruling in 2004 that a Congress critter should not engage in fundraising, quote, that gives even an appearance that donors will receive special treatment. Now, fast forward to last year, when the independent investigative arm of the House Ethics Committee charged two Republicans and one Democrat with DeLay-style money hustles. The investigators found compelling proof that these powerful members collected checks from Wall Street lobbyists just before voting their way on regulatory reforms. Emails and other incriminating documents show that one of the eager check collectors even left the Capitol while the House was debating the reforms so he could attend the fundraiser being thrown for him at a lobbyist's home. He then returned to the floor to vote against the reforms exactly as his grinning Wall Street donors wanted. The punishment for these miscreants? None. In one of its first acts this year, the new Ethics Committee merely dropped all charges against their delighted colleagues. In an Alice in Wonderland moment, the committee declared on January 26 that there was no connection between the vote and the cash, adding that no, quote, reasonable person would see even an appearance of impropriety in the exchange. This is Jim Hightower saying, excuse me for being unreasonable, but it appears obvious that what the committee has done is to set an ethical standard for this Congress that's even lower than the dark days of Tom DeLay.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachmann, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
Well, you know, last night we talked about the GOP hatred of women and children. The fact that they want to cut the supplemental nutrition program for infants, women, and children by 6% or a $758 million slashing to the bone. They also want to cut $210 million from the maternal and child health care block grants. Again, you know, this is one of those things, you know, the pro-birth people, we gotta get them children popped out. But yet we don't care if they're healthy or not. Because this program gives low-income pregnant women and their children and their mothers health access to health care. Yet, I guess we don't care about that. Amazing stuff. You know, and for me, I look at that and I see, and down the road, we're going to end up paying that back in multiples. And, you know, again, I'm not against sacrifice. I'm not against the idea of tightening the belt a little bit when it's needed. I don't think it's necessary now because I'm not seeing the people at the top sacrificing. And, you know, like we just talked about with the Stephen Zerlinga, you know, we have the ability as a society to dictate what happens. And for right now, too much of the reward is going to those at the top. Too much accumulation of wealth in the hands of too few, which for me, again, takes me back to this idea of why we need strong labor unions, why we need collective bargaining, why people like Jessica Irvine is walking on the picket line to make her life a little bit better. That's why. So anyway, the Republicans had to show again, you know, why they seem to hate women. A new Republican bill that is coming out defunding the health and abortion services of Planned Parenthood. We knew this was coming. They want to eliminate $327 million in funding for Title X, which is a family planning program that began back under, you know, you start thinking about Nixon being a liberal and you start going, wow, he's the guy who set up Title X to make sure that women had access to health services. Well, that's it. What they're doing now is they're saying, well, the right is going, well, we're going to defund all of that. Now, understand, Title X money cannot be used for abortions under any circumstances. Can't happen. It's already part of the law, but that's how they're spinning this. They're spinning this as, well, we're going to make sure that they can't get abortions. The bill sponsor, Mike Pence, Republican from Indiana, that's how he's framing it. We don't want to pay for them government abortions. And understand, it doesn't happen. what they do is they spend money on contraception. They spend money on planning. The abortion services, that's something else. They get fundraising for that. But this, I'm amazed. And I've been saying this for years. The GOP wants to go back and undo the Griswold decision. Because really it was the basis for Roe versus Wade. But more importantly, if women cannot control the number of children they have, the number of children they bear, then they themselves can be controlled. And again, I go back to the male chauvinist side of me. I wouldn't mind if my wife had to be subservient to me, had to depend on me, doing whatever I wanted. I might actually think that's pretty cool. The problem is I've got daughters. And to be honest, I really don't want to spend the rest of my life in prison for killing somebody, some guy who's abusing one of them. I don't think I'd want to do that. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. We got Joe on the line. How are we doing tonight, Joe?
Hey, pretty good, man. I was listening to the Walmart rant and then listening to this. The only way we're going to stop the GOP at this point is by recall elections. Two years ago, the GOP sent the Tea Parties out and stomped their feet and acted like a bunch of children in front of town hall meetings and stuff. So Democrats don't do that. For whatever reason, I don't know if they're, I don't know if you can say we're wussy or whatever. We don't get out and get in people's face like that. We won't unify ourselves in that manner. But if we start running recall elections and challenging the laws that allow these guys to sit there for the 2 years, we have to do something to put them back on their heels.
Now, I don't know many states that have recall elections.
Then we got to challenge for it. We got to work. We have to. The ace is in the hole in any the bishops on the chessboard for any political organization are the lawyers. We need to get decent attorneys that can figure out ways to start the bollocks up in the court system, a way to challenge for recall. You know what I mean?
Well, let me ask you this. If we go down this road, what says that you don't have these recalls all the time and then you end up in a system of gridlock where nothing gets done because you're recalling everybody because nobody's happy?
Well, you got a better solution to
I don't. And that's why I just
stop this stuff because people aren't at this point. When you look at the election from last year, if you take the raw numbers out of this, 15% were the people who decided the election. That's what the GOP got out of the general population, 15%.
Yep.
And the only thing more disappointing to that, more depressing than that, was the Democrats couldn't come up with 16%. So the people have checked out. They've walked away from the system, and they're thinking we're all flipping nuts.
Well, let me ask you this, Joe, because you know you stop and you think about it. What's it going to take to get that other 70%? Since you said 15% decided, what's to get the rest of the people involved? I've been saying for the longest time, I think we need mass collapse. I think you need something like the Great Depression to wake people up. You go back to the old saying of when people's stomachs are empty, their heads get right.
I don't know. I don't know if we have to go that far. I can give you a couple examples right down the line. One is I've called you before on this.
Yep.
The ratio of Congress people to people. We have about 310 million people, and it breaks down to about 710,000 people per congressman. So people don't vote in the elections because their vote doesn't mean anything.
Right.
So if you double the size of Congress, you got a better chance to say, hey, my vote will mean something. Or you'll be able to get that candidate. How many union guys are sitting in Congress now? I can think of Bob Brady. Can you think of any others?
Misha from Maine.
Okay, so we got two out of 435.
Right.
So you double the size of Congress, you got a better shot at getting union representation into the Congress, because we'll get people who look like us serving us. You know, it's really bizarre that Pennsylvania increases population. In the last three census, we increased our population in each of them, but between the last three census, we've lost four seats. So it's not a representative democracy. It's not a republic. It's this series of chips that are being moved across the board to say, oh, you don't have enough. We have enough over here. Wyoming's the least number, so we're going to use this as a counterweight to say, all right, this is how we're going to represent ourselves. That's not the way it was originally designed. And I can go Tea Party on you on this, saying we've walked away from the original way of doing things. The original way of doing things all through the 19th century, we were increasing Congress people as we increase population or we increase states.
Right. A number pops into my head, and I forget right off the top of my head what the number that I thought 30,000 popped into my head as a number from the beginning.
The beginning, yes. And they never codified that as an amendment. That was like up for being the Second Amendment, actually, to codify it at 30,000. But that's not going to be, we both know it's not going to be a realistic number at this point. But if you look at the rest of the planet, we're the second worst on the planet. India is the only one that's worse. And we're set in second place by a long shot. If a lot of the industrialized countries are sitting around 450 as far as their number, and even that's high and it's rough. But if we had more people in there, we got more shots for Bob Brady, or we have more shots for Alan Grayson, or we have more shots for people who have their heads screwed on straight, that's one place where we can do it. I don't think, and you can actually make this argument to Republicans, too, to say that we're out of whack, because you can feed them the line, look, you don't have to pay as much, you don't have to raise as much money to keep your seat anymore, because you only have to raise half the money.
Yeah, good point. That I'll agree with you on. I'm not so keen on the recall stuff.
But we need something to push these guys back on their heels.
Well, what we need is to get the corporate money out of the game.
Well, the only way you can do that is by splitting the districts, or doubling the districts, and because then the field operations mean more than the air operations. The air operations meaning expensive media, meaning the television, meaning the radio, meaning the print. You can get more, you'll be able to get more people on, in the trenches essentially, to be able to refocus that election back down to the real grassroots. People talk grassroots and it's all corporate stuff.
Right. Excellent points, Joe. I appreciate the call. I got to take
a
break.
One other thing. You reached out to me yesterday.
Yes, I did.
Do you still want to talk about what you reached out to me for?
I got a guest in the next segment. I do, and we'll talk about that again. Is that all right?
Sounds good to me, dude.
All right, thanks so
much. Have yourself a good one, man.
You too, brother. We're going to take a quick break right back after this with Mike Fedor, Cumberland County Commissioner candidate, back after this.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425. Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. And going back to what Joe was saying in the last segment, you know, the idea of having closer ties to your representative, being able to pick up the phone and maybe talk to them. I do agree that the districts have gotten so large, the number of people that they represent have gotten, in my opinion, too large. And I would agree, we do need to consider, and, you know, with the T-Twizzlers and nuts, that would probably not happen. But we do need to consider, I think, expanding the number of people who represent us so that we have that personal relationship. And as we move into this year and towards elections, I think the local elections, your county commissioner elections, your mayor elections, those are the real important ones. Those are the ones that really affect your lives. But we don't seem to get as excited about them. I think we should. That's why I've asked Mike Fedor. He's a candidate for the Cumberland County Commissioner's spot to come and talk to us a little bit about his bid and his vision for the county. Mike, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, my pleasure, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
Again, the website, votefedor.com. I see you picked up a couple of what I would call significant endorsements for your bid to be Cumberland County Commissioner.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been an exciting week. I was just thrilled to have my brothers and sisters of the labor community behind me in this race. Earlier in the week, the Central Pennsylvania Building and Construction and Trades Council made its endorsement public. We were thrilled about that. Construction, as you know, is such a major part of the Cumberland economy. A lot of men and women make their living working out in construction, and we want to make sure more of it is done the right way. In Cumberland County, that means people have access to, you know, good jobs and benefits and protections at work. Then yesterday we announced that the Harrisburg Region Central Labor Council, the AFL-CIO, also extended its endorsement to us, and that's thrilling because that's 20,000 men and women who are union members and retirees who come from all walks of life. They're like firefighters, and they're auditors, and they're steelworkers, and they're machinists, and they're nurses, and their support is really a widespread section of the economy. And then just tonight, I'm just completely honored to be endorsed by AFSCME District Council 89. I went to their meeting tonight. They don't normally get involved in a primary, but what Director Mike Fox said tonight was there's something very special about this election. We have a working class candidate we can really believe in running, and we have to get out there and support them. And so I won their endorsement tonight, and I'm just honored to have it.
You know, and going back to a phone call we had in the last segment, you know, the guy said, you know, how many union members, how many union supporters do we have in the halls of Congress? And I argue we need to have more working class people taking that plunge, getting involved into the political process. And it's an ugly process for some. And, you know, I give you all the credit in the world for throwing your hat into the ring and what I would think putting your family in that fishbowl as well.
Absolutely. I mean, it's no small thing to run for office. And when you run for a county office, you know, all eyes come on you pretty quickly. We had a fundraiser tonight. We were just meeting some people in the county. And, you know, you got a banner 8 feet wide with your name on it. You know, it's not a secret anymore, right?
You're not going to sneak up on anybody.
No, not at all. So, you know, I really owe just a lot to my wife. She's my teammate in this race. She's just working hard to make sure we can do what we need to do. And, you know, we got two small babies, so it's no small thing when you got to be out late tonight, you know, talking to people to make sure that the kids are taken care of. So it is important, though, as you said, that working class people get out there and do this, because working class people are going to get out there and they're going to fight for other working class people. They're going to approach the problems facing our county government, our local government, with the values and the approaches that we approach problems in our own lives, which is mostly through common sense and through consensus building and not the, you know, the corporate approach of who's the highest bidder, who can grease the pockets the most. That's the person we'll hand the solutions to. So you're right. We need more working class folk standing up. And as I said tonight, it's not enough just for me to go out there and win this race. I have got to be working to build a party and to build a movement to fight for the things we want to achieve as commissioner, because it's not three people in a room in Carlisle that make these decisions. It's people organizing in the streets and towns across the county that will actually put pressure to do the things we want to do in Cumberland County.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're Mike Fedor, candidate for Cumberland County Commissioner. VoteFedor.com is the website. We've got a link at our site at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Mike Fedor's name. It'll take you right there. You know, you bring up organizing, and I think, you know, that's the right approach. Having lived in Cumberland County for a number of years, I don't see that grassroots organizing. I don't see that excitement that I would like to see, because as a Democrat, you're going to be the minority in the room, I think, if history tells us anything. So it's going to take someone who can build that consensus, someone who can get grassroots groups together to kind of push if we're going to get the kind of invest and smart policy that we need to take Cumberland County in the 21st century.
Absolutely. Listen, I was on Duncannon Borough Council for several years, and what I found out there was, and that's a 75% Republican town, and I was the only Democrat on the Borough Council, but I found that the issues there at the local level, you know, rarely were about Democrat or Republican. They were about people's values and what did they think was important. I think the same is, you know, my approach to county government is going to be the same. It's not about Democrat or Republican to me. Hey, I'm happy to be the minority commissioner just as I'd be happy to be a majority commissioner. For me, it's about having an impact as a county commissioner and approaching these very difficult challenges that are part of a gathering storm on the horizon. There's going to be some challenges we're going to have to face, and I want to stare those down and bring some common sense values to addressing those problems. And, you know, also part of this, too, the endorsement of AFSCME, people, you know, they think that labor unions are just all Democrats, but it's important to note that AFSCME is actually, you know, about a third Democrat and about a third Republican and about a third independent in a county. And so, for me, this is a tremendous endorsement because this expands my base. This gives me an opportunity to reach across the county and bring some new people into this election and make me, I think, a very strong candidate, not only in the spring primary on May 17th, but the fall election on November 8th.
So let me ask you this. You know, what's the vision? What does Mike Fedor see the future of Cumberland County? As commissioner, what is it that you'll pursue?
Well, listen, my wife and I made a conscious choice to move to Cumberland County. We want to raise our kids here, Jackson and Parker. It's already a wonderful county, but I know that that you can take it for granted that stuff just happens, right? It doesn't just happen. It takes hard work and planning to have as fiscally as sound county as we have right now, and some of the really important services we have that people rely on. It takes an incredible staff at the courthouse next to the county to run them. I want Cumberland County to be stronger, and the way we do that is we have to get back to focusing on creating the right environment for job creation, and not just any job, good jobs, jobs that can support families and grow communities. We need to focus on protecting vital family services, the services that working people rely on to be a bridge between paychecks or to help them with addiction, to make sure that, God forbid, kids aren't going to bed hungry at night. Those services are going to come under attack by people who just want to slash and burn county budgets and local budgets. I'm the type of person that's going to stand up and say, no, we're not going to cut those things. They reflect our values, and we're going to find ways to make sure they continue to be funded. And then I think we need a solid plan for the future. We need a plan for the future of agriculture in our county. It's vital that it remains an important industry. But we also have got to be talking about real solutions to moving our people through the county. We need to build a transit culture that includes rail and includes you know, better services to trolleys or buses or things to move our residents around, whether they're 18-year-olds or senior citizens. Overall, you know, I want to see our county moving forward and becoming the strongest county in South Central PA.
I got to tell you, Mike, you've got that whole commissioner thing down already. I give you the microphone and you just go. Three of the questions that I had already thought up, you rambled right on through. So, you know, good for you.
Hey, don't, I'm not rambling. I've been going all day long. So.
I get it, you know, because for me, transportation is a huge issue. Commuting from Carlisle into Harrisburg every day, I see the traffic backing up. I see it getting worse. If we don't have somebody who has some vision of how to take care of that problem, in 10 years, it's going to be 100 times worse.
You know, if you've ever been to Minneapolis, St. Paul, you know that their transit system runs right down the median of the highway, right along the highway, so that while you're sitting in traffic, and you're not going anywhere. You watch six or seven trains go by. It starts to put a light bulb off in your head. Holy cow, I could have been home by now if I was riding the train. That's how you build a culture of transit within a community. You put it, you don't hide it, right? You put this stuff front and center. And we got to start somewhere. So, you know, we obviously aren't going to start with laying the track. First thing we got to start with is, you know, creating a place where people are going to go to park and rides and kiss and rides that will eventually become the train stations in 5 or 6 years. But, Rick, as you know, we have a president now who believes in mass transit, believes in high speed rail. Cumberland County's got to get off its butt and find a way to put a plan together so we can be in line for that money.
Absolutely.
Not going to be there forever.
Absolutely. Because, you know, we went to Washington, D.C. this week, and we hit traffic going down. And I kept sitting there going, it's an absolute crime that there is not a spur, a link, whatever you want to call it, that goes from Harrisburg, the Carlisle-Harrisburg area, into Washington, D.C. It's just an absolute crime that there is no way other than going from Harrisburg to Philadelphia to Washington to take a train to the nation's capital.
Absolutely. Hey, someone was at my event tonight telling me that back in the day, they used to love to ride a train from Harrisburg to Washington, D.C. That was before we dismantled the train system in this country. You know, we've got to go back. It's not impossible. The stuff is still there. There's the infrastructure potentially there. Hey, we know how to do it. But, you know, China has built, four, five high-speed trains? Well, we've talked about doing our first.
Yep.
We've got to find a way to get off our butts and get it done. This is America. We got to be able to build a high-speed train. We've got to build a dozen high-speed trains in this country. This is the place where we invented that type of technology, and we lead the world in innovation, so let's get it done.
Absolutely. Mike Fedor, candidate for Cumberland County Commissioner, votefedor.com. If somebody wanted to help, someone to make a donation, what do we tell them?
Well, you can go to votefedor.com. That site has actually got it's a holding page for now. It's going to be a full-blown site after our endorsement meeting on Saturday, and we find out what the Democratic committee is going to do in the county. But right now, if you go to votefedor.com, you'll find links to our Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. And we actually have a donation tool on Facebook. If you go to our Facebook page, you can go and make a donation through fundraiser. If you have a PayPal account and it's secure, you can get a credit card. You can also mail contributions. The address is on the website.
All right.
For Pennsylvania.
All right, Mike, I appreciate your time. Look forward to having you back again real soon as this heats up. And get out there and knock on some doors.
Hey, you bet. I'm going to be doing it every single day till Election Day, May 17th.
All righty. We look forward to having you back, Mike. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick, for your time.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
The radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can fix anything? That's Mike.
Call them at 3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how we may give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service.
Mike, and you pocket the savings.
That's 240-3211. Mike at Klein's Appliance.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a 888-520-7425.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to win the road, from AFSCME Council 13, creation of state, county, and municipal employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. I'll never see that AFSCME member working in a diving underwater to repair a bridge or a 911 call. But aren't you glad to? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, nuts. Rick Smith.